On episode 246 of the Tennis Files podcast, you'll learn Mike Digby's top lessons learned from practicing with the best players on the planet.
Welcome to the Tennis Files podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
If you feel like you watch too many poachable balls whiz by you and you're like, ugh, I should have poached on that one, then you should check out the doubles playbook, because inside there are 48 plays from Martina Navratilova and the Bryan brothers that show you how to set up easy putaway volleys and overheads. If you look at other sports, teams run plays. Football teams run plays to score touchdowns, soccer teams run plays to score goals, and basketball teams run plays to score baskets. When it comes to your doubles game, you can run plays to set up easy putaway volleys and overheads. If you go to tennisfiles.com/doublesplaybook, Martina Navratilova will personally show you one of her all-time favorite plays called the Prognosticator, so you can see if the doubles playbook is right for you. I've used many of the plays from the doubles playbook in my doubles matches and think you should definitely take a look at it if you want to improve your doubles game. Just go to tennisfiles.com/doublesplaybook to check it out. That's tennisfiles.com/doublesplaybook to check it out right now.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Hey there, this is Mehrban Iranshad, your host. I hope you're having a great day, and I am definitely heavily at work these days, especially on Tennis Summit 2022, which starts on April 18th. I'm actually doing a live stream with my good friend Peter Freeman the day before to kick things off. And if you're interested in joining that, then go to tennisfilesummit.com or check the link in the show notes page. But today we have a fantastic interview with Mike Digby. Mike currently coaches at the Soto Tennis Academy in Spain. He was a former U.S. collegiate tennis player who graduated fairly recently, actually in 2019. And he worked as a full-time hitting partner with top players such as Roger Federer, Novak Djokovic, Stefanos Tsitsipas, Rafael Nadal, Simona Halep, and many, many others, countless others. So it was really cool to talk to Mike about his experiences with both these players and their coaching staffs, and you know what he's learned from them, as well as some of the funny experiences, both good and bad. So I think that'll be interesting for you, very interesting, in fact. And I had heard of Mike from actually a couple of my subscribers to the Tennis Files newsletter, as well as hearing him on a few podcasts as well, including the Functional Tennis Podcast. So definitely glad that I heard about Mike, because it's always really fun for me to hear about people who are playing at the highest level or who have played people who are at that level at some point. So I will get straight to the interview. And this is actually part one of my interview with Mike. So it was a fairly long chat. So we'll have part two next week. So without further ado, here is my interview with Mike Digby. Hey, everybody. It's an honor and a pleasure to have on Mike Digby onto the podcast. And I actually got some emails asking me to get Mike on, which was really cool to learn about, you know, his journey. And then I listened to a couple podcasts about his background, and it you know, I love interviewing players who have played at the elite levels. And obviously, as you've heard in the intro, Mike has been playing with, you know, all the best players in the world, and now he's coaching at an elite level as well at a, you know, a pretty young age, I'd say. So Mike, welcome to the show, and thanks a lot for coming on.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, of course, Mike. I just want to get started by asking you a fun question that I ask most of my guests, which is, how did you get your start playing tennis?
Oh, yeah, great question. Well, I was very young. I think like a lot of players, I was probably 4 or 5. My dad actually played badminton to quite a high level. So I think, and then my mom played like tennis to a relatively high level, both in England. So I think naturally it kind of ran in the family with the whole idea of racket sports and all of that. So I, yeah, they took me down to the park just to a tennis court, and from the word go, I was pretty good. I managed to get the ball over the net. So I think at that age, it's an achievement. So I think from there on in, I just loved every aspect of the sport, and yeah, kind of really, really enjoyed it from that age as well.
Very cool, Mike. And I know this is a tennis podcast, obviously, but I was curious when you said that your dad got to a high level at badminton. Like, I wonder, how does that, like, what's the highest levels of badminton, and, you know, what types of tournaments was he playing?
So, yeah, I mean, he played to a relatively good level when he was younger, when he was maybe 20, 21. I wouldn't say like an international level, but he played like nationally, within like his university and everything. So he always had good hand-eye coordination. I think that's the biggest thing as any, you know, athlete that plays any racket sport, you know, whether it's badminton, tennis. And so, yeah, I think naturally from a younger age, I kind of picked that up quite quickly. And I played a number of sports, really, but it was tennis was the one that I seemed to just be better at. And I think when you're at that age, when you're good at something, you're going to enjoy it more anyway. So, yeah, he played to a pretty good level, which allowed me to have some good hand-eye coordination.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And then, you know, it's really important to just to learn for, especially for tennis parents, young kids and everything. Like, how did you, you know, what types of training did you go through? Like, starting from when you, you know, like, I guess you mentioned at like, was it 5 or 7 that you started playing, you know, a lot? And then, what types of like training environments did you have, at that age and after?
Yeah, I was very lucky. My parents were never pushy. I think they wanted me from the age of 5 or so all the way through to 11 or 12. I played football, I played cricket, I played rugby, I played tennis, and just to get a feel for all sports. And like I said, my parents were both pretty sporty, athletic. So they wanted an environment that was fun. I think that's one of the reasons why I enjoy, you know, working in the sport is it's fun. I was put in an environment that didn't have much pressure. They just wanted me to play, to enjoy myself. And that shouldn't change when you get to 11 or 12. You should still have all the way through, whether you're a recreational player, all the way through to if you're playing an elite level in the professional game. It has to be fun. So yeah, for me, the biggest reason that I think I continued playing all the way throughout my teenage years and still now, I enjoyed it. So I was put in the right environment to allow me to, you know, stay in the sport.
I love that, Mike. Super important there. And like, what is it about tennis? What elements or characteristics about tennis is it that you really love and enjoy? Because I think sometimes, a lot of times we forget about that and then we get burned out. But so what is it for you about tennis that you love?
I think I'm a very competitive person. Like a very competitive person. So I think it's that one-on-one battle that I love. Like I always say, you know, whether I was a hitting partner or now I'm coaching, it's like a game of chess. You know, you're always trying to get one move ahead of your opponent. And I always loved that element, even if at times when I was younger, I didn't realize I loved that element. I think now I'm a little bit older. I just love those battles, you know, being able to try and figure opponents out. I love the athleticism of the sport. There's no hiding. You know, there's no hiding. You either win a match because, you know, you played really well or you've competed really well, or you lose a match because your opponent was better or you just didn't, you know, you weren't quite good enough on the day. So yeah, there's nowhere to hide in tennis. And I think I relish that. I love that element. And I think, yeah, it's one of the best sports in the world, and maybe I'm being a little bit biased, but I think from a competitive standpoint, it's one of the best sports.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Mike. I did a very, very unscientific study in a sense where I emailed like 70 of the top college tennis coaches and wrote an article about it, like asking them, you know, the top character traits of, you know, the best student athlete tennis players, and their number one trait, you know, overall was competitiveness. So
100%.
You know, that's a huge one. Yeah, for sure. And then did you, you know, after age 12 and such, did you go to any sort of, you know, academies or anything like that? Or was it just like mainly private training, or how was that environment for you?
Yeah. So when I hit about 12, 13, I would say, I think I then realized that I was, you know, I was pretty good. Like I could play, and it almost to the point where I think I probably had to drop a couple of sports to maybe take tennis a little bit more seriously. So I ended up from about 12 or 13, just playing tennis. And I was part of, near my hometown, they have like some like development centers and performance centers within like the LTA kind of system. And they have them scattered around the UK. And I kind of, yeah, was part of that for a few years. And yeah, I would say I was a late developer. I wouldn't say I was one of the best juniors at all, age 12, 13, 14 even. I think I probably started to develop a little later and yeah, when I was maybe 16, 17, before I ended up going to college, I probably, yeah, started to get a little bit better relatively quickly. So yeah, never really a part of many academies or anything like that, more private training. But yeah, we had a good base near where I live, which helped me out.
Excellent, Mike. And then in terms of like the, you know, the progression through the rankings, I mean, obviously you, as we'll talk about, you know, soon, you've been able to practice against so many of the top players in the world. So what, in terms of tournaments and rankings and such, like at what point did you reach, you know, a high level in the rankings? And, you know, just talk us through that like, experience for you.
Well, I'd honestly say I was a little bit different to most in the sense that I never really had a ranking that was much to brag about. I wouldn't say my level was anywhere near some of the best juniors in the country, you know, even into 15, 16. I probably shied away from competition a little bit, which I think I've seen in a lot of junior players now being a young coach myself. So I think that's quite normal. So yeah, I was always, you know, I was one of the best in my like region, but I was never one of the best in the country at all. So I think that's almost in a way what I'm most proud of with what I've been able to achieve as a younger person, hitting partner coach. I think, and it's a good advocate for a lot of people out there, that you don't have to be this top 10, top 5 ranked national junior in order to achieve a lot in the sport. I think there's a lot more to achieve than just playing in the sport of tennis. So yeah, I would say I started to get better the later I played going into my college years.
Very nice, very nice. And then talk us through you know, the decision that, you know, on which college to go to and such, and you know, the experience there.
Yeah, so I pretty much very quickly around the ages of 16, 17 knew I wanted to go to college. It was a relatively new thing in the UK. Well, I say new thing. It was new for me. Not a lot of people that I knew in my area went to college. There was maybe one or two that I knew, but I was told that it would be a really good decision for me, being a little bit of a late developer, giving me an extra 3-4 years to compete and also combine that with getting a degree. So I looked at a lot of Division I schools, and I'd say I got quite a few Division I offers, but I always thought that, look, for me to get matches in, to play, to compete, to enjoy my time competing and try and, you know, win as many matches as I possibly could, I was always considering Division II as well. And I ended up going to a Division II school, a good Division II school. And, you know, it was an amazing 4 years. Like, it was really, really good for my development as a tennis player. I played, well, hundreds of matches over the 4 years, singles and doubles combined. So yeah, and ended up having, I think, one of the, maybe the third best win ratio or something in my team in history in college for the team that I played for. So it was a gamble between, look, I could play lots of matches, maybe at Division II level, or not as many matches at Division I. So I always wanted to try and play more matches. And so I just thought Division II was a better option for me at the time.
Yeah, that's awesome, Mike. And, you know, we were talking about a Premier League football, or, you know, American soccer, I guess, or, you know, when you're an American, you say soccer. And it's almost like, I guess, you know, a player in the Premier League, you know, playing in the championship so they can, you know, play all the matches. But then you, you know, you see them like play in the FA Cup against a Premier League team, and then they, you know, they beat them, or they, you know, they play at the high level. Pretty similar there. Cool. And then, you know, what's really interesting is that I really want to get to is just like your journey and how you're able to play with, you know, all of the greatest players here, like Federer, Tsitsipas, Nadal, Djokovic, Halep, who you've forged a nice relationship with and play, practice with consistently. So how did that all come about?
So I was in my sophomore year in college, and a couple of years before I'd started to play German league. In Germany, they have a lot, like the Bundesliga, they have lots of divisions in Germany where I would go over and play that. So I started to play a little bit more there. And then over the summer, I would always come back into Europe and try and compete a little bit for 3-4 months kind of summer break. And I'd finished German league and I'd just got home and I messaged my coach and said, look, can we do a few sessions? I wouldn't mind practicing a little bit this week because I'm back, you know, back from Germany. And he said, oh, well, actually, look, there's this opportunity that's come up for to be a hitting partner at Wimbledon. And I said, oh, right, yeah, cool, that'd be amazing. And he gave me the contact that then, you know, I then went down to the Roehampton, the National Tennis Center, and practiced with a couple of players so they could kind of gauge my level a little bit. And they liked me. They liked what I saw. And also being a lefty, I think, helped a lot with the amount of lefties that are in the draw, especially with, you know, your Nadals, Kvitovas, those kind of players, you always need a lefty hitting partner around. So, yeah, I then ended up going to Wimbledon that year and practiced with Djokovic for the majority of the tournament, as well as abundance of other players, Batista Agu, John Isner, Naomi Osaka, and all these players. And I think that was almost, without me realizing it, halfway through college, my in to then do what I did over the you know, following 3 years or so, and still continue to do now occasionally. So that's kind of how it all started, really.
And that's brilliant. And then I guess, you know, I've always been curious about like the level required, you know, to be a practice partner, because, you know, the City Open is near me, pretty close by. And then I see some of the practice partners there. And, you know, I think I've talked to a couple of them, and I mean, some of them said that you could even be like a pretty high level junior as long as you have like your strokes are consistent. But I was curious, you know, from your perspective, what level is needed? Because I'm sure it's even a dream for a lot of people to be a practice partner at a local tournament and hit with the, you know, the big guns. So what's the level do you think that's needed?
It's a really difficult question, because reality is every player requires something different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what someone like a Daniil Medvedev wants out of a hitting partner might be different to what Kvitova wants, to what Simona Halep wants. So I think that, look, obviously you have to be playing at a very, very high level to be able to compete with them and practice with them regularly. You know, in the scheme of you know, the tennis players that are out there, you have to be playing to a high level. And I think I made the role my own. And that sounds a little bit strange, but I always knew that I was never one of the best tennis players. I always knew that I was never the highest nationally ranked junior, but I always knew that I was good enough to compete and practice with these players. And I genuinely started it out as an amazing experience that I wanted to, you know, practice, because I was still playing myself. So in my mind, when I went to Wimbledon for the first time, it was very much a case of, this is great 2 weeks to practice and have this incredible experience that could open up so many doors in the future. But I never knew how good I was in regards to being able to practice with someone like a Novak. But I think, like anything, when you settle, if you're a good player, then your level can shine through if you're good enough. And I managed to settle quite quickly. He made it pretty comfortable for me. And I think if you're a good, like you say, a good junior, then, you know, there's no reason why anyone that's got a relatively good level can practice with these guys and girls.
Yeah, that's great stuff, Mike. I've got a lot of follow-ups there. I guess the first one that I can remember is so your first, you know, your was it your first practice was with a Novak? Is that what you said?
Okay. Yeah. So it's a funny story there. I remember walking in and meeting everyone for the first time, everyone behind the practice desk. And they always used to give me like a list of the hits that I'd have that day. And I remember the first one being Djokovic.
And, the first one.
Yeah, it's a little bit surreal. And it's funny because everyone thinks that must be the hardest one. And for some people maybe, and there's some players that I actually found a lot harder to practice with, but for lots of different reasons. But yeah, but I think it's like anything. It's amazing what the power of connection can with an athlete. Like if you can connect with anyone and build up that relationship, I eventually, with quite a few players that I practice with regularly, I didn't view them as this superstar. I viewed them as someone that I just got along with and I'm practicing with. So then it almost like, yeah, it detaches that emotion of, oh my God, I'm practicing with Djokovic, or oh my God, I'm practicing with Federer. It's more so a case of then, oh, you know what? I'm actually just practicing with someone that's very good at tennis and it's their job. So I think that settled me quite quickly when I was able to build a relationship with a lot of the players. I settled very quickly. So then actually I ended up improving because I was practicing with them so much. So yeah, it was a surreal first experience.
Very cool. Yeah, I've got a couple friends who've been on the podcast, Milan Krinitin and then Gibran Muhammad, and they both practiced with Novak Djokovic as well. And it seemed like he was very friendly. And, you know, I remember Gibran was like showing him his kids and they were talking about like being fathers and things like that. So that was super cool. Yeah. Curious, could you take us through like the practice, like what types of, you know, drills and such that you all did during that first practice?
Yeah, so first practice, I can remember. Yeah, yeah. No, I think I always kind of break it down to 2 days. You have match day and then you have the practice day, especially when you're at the Grand Slams. So
yeah.
A match day is really basic, often just half an hour, 45 minutes where you just run through everything. Just like anyone would do to warm up for a match. You know, no different at all in any way, shape or form. They might run like a particular pattern on the court that they're looking to implement in the match. So it might be that someone like a Djokovic knows that he's playing Nadal. So his backhand down the line is going to be particularly important that day to try and get it into Nadal's backhand. So he might just spend a little bit more time spending 10, 15 minutes just practicing the backhand down the line. But other than that, the majority of the prep is done obviously way before the tournament. But in regards to that specific match, the practice day is where they will then spend an hour and a half or so running through certain things that they want to try and implement on the court from a tactical standpoint. So again, if we use the Djokovic-Nadal example, the idea of him really practicing transitioning, going hard into Nadal's forehand to open up his backhand would be a pattern that I suspect he would use. And we've seen him use, you know, many times when he's played Nadal. And so yeah, there's almost two separate days, which you know, entail completely different practices in a way, but a lot of generic stuff that a lot of players that at any level would be practicing, you know, anywhere in the world.
Very cool. Yeah. I remember listening yesterday to the Control Controllables podcast. And then you mentioned that you, you know, you learned how to like hang back a bit more and like hit heavier. Cause I guess you like to take balls pretty early generally.
Yeah.
So that was cool to hear about, but I was wondering, I guess, how did your approach to being a practice partner change, if at all, like, you know, from the first time, the first experience to later on? Did you make any adjustments moving forward?
In regards to my game, the way I played?
Well, it could be anything, actually. Either mentally or how you played or anything like that.
Not so much. I think kind of along those lines, the one thing that I realized relatively quickly and that I really latched onto was actually learning more from the coaches than the actual hitting. I think at that period, I always had aspirations when I started my hitting to play professionally. I always wanted to give it a try and kind of just see how it went. But I think once the hitting started to kind of, not take over, but I started to do a lot more of it and I had some interest from lots of players, I was enjoying it so much that I felt like that I also could implement a lot of the stuff that the coaches were saying to me into plays that I could coach and eventually try and maybe coach at that level, which is something that I still aspire to do. So I think the biggest thing that with my mindset that kind of switched over the years as a hitting partner was I got really almost obsessed in becoming a coach. And it was always something that I think I had in the back of my mind anyway. And when you start to get a little bit more friendly with a lot of the coaches on tour, they're more willing to help you out, give you some advice. And I learned so much by just observing what they did with the players that I was hitting with, that actually I built up quite a nice knowledge base for a younger coach at that level. So I was, you know, very, very lucky to be able to spend some time with some you know, top coaches who have coached on tour a lot. So that would be my biggest almost mindset shift from starting out as a hitting partner to now 3-4 years down the line.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Can you share maybe like the top two or three tactical based tips that you've learned either from all the practices or from, you know, from the coaches of those players?
I think the one that sticks out for me is, and it's often neglected and sometimes misunderstood, is practice your strengths more than you practice your weaknesses. I think often we kind of always look to, and naturally as human beings, we look to the things that we're not so good at. So if, for example, in my game that my forehand is not so good, then, oh, I need to work on my forehand every day, all the time. Now, yes, obviously you do. There's elements of you have to practice your weaknesses. You want to try and get them better. But at the end of the day, Federer isn't going to be standing there and hitting millions of backhands because ultimately he wants to be on his forehand as much as he can. So I think that was something as a young person, let alone a coach, that really hit me and changed, I guess, my mindset is, just practice your strengths more, just implement those strengths as much as you can as a player, because that ultimately is what's going to win you matches. So that would probably be my big one. And then kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, just trying to become the best competitor that you can possibly be. I think when you become a top 100 player, a top 200 player, everyone can play tennis. Everyone can hit a forehand. Everyone can hit a backhand. Everyone's pretty athletic. Everyone can serve pretty well. Everyone can return pretty well. But the players that are ultra successful are the ones that can compete the best. And I think just reinforcing daily, like strong competitive, having a competitive environment and understanding what a competitor means, even for the top 100 players, that's what wins the matches. Look, I'm incredibly impressed with Nadal's forehand, with Federer's forehand, with Djokovic's returns, but I'm more impressed with their ability to do all of that as a competitor under pressure, under extreme pressure. And that's what makes them the great champions that they are.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Mike. And then in terms of, you know, I know you touched upon this a bit, but I guess I'm trying to dig into like commonalities among like the majority of the pros that you practice with, whether that's like, you know, their routines or mentally or, you know, strategically, like anything like that, that you can kind of share that, you know, most of them have or all of them.
So I think there's two things for me that stand out with all of the players that I've practiced with and or been around. One of them is the amount of off-court work that they do, their preparation. Mm-hmm. It's more impressive to me, again, than on the court. They're, you know, spending 45 minutes to an hour before their match, whether that's doing prehab, whether that's stretching, whether that's rolling out, whether that's having a massage, physio, just preparing the body and also the mind to practice and compete. And again, that then doesn't finish once the practice done. They do the same thing. And again, the post rehab, everything that is entails to being a professional athlete, let alone a professional tennis player. So I think if my one bit of advice to players, you know, that are looking or aspiring to be professional, is just really buy into all of the off-court work that is required. Because again, like I reiterate, once you once you become a certain level, the tennis, yes, as much as that is important to keep improving and improve the elements of your game from a tactical and technical standpoint, but the day-to-day habits that you set yourself and all of the recovery that's needed is vital. So they're all incredibly good at that and are so driven and value those areas of their game so much. And the other word that I use a lot with them all is they're relentless. They're just relentless. Whether that's when they're competing, as we all get to see on TV, but in their practices, it's just relentless, like just doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. And the best players, they all do the basics incredibly well. It's just to such a high level. And that might simply be, you know, being able to open up the court with their forehand. That is as simple as that. Really simple drills around, right, okay, when you get a short ball, transit, go down the line and transition forward. But they do it with such minute detail to the point where the basics are done so, so well. And I think a lot of people think that they've got this, like the coaches sprinkle some magic dust over their head and all of a sudden they're doing these incredible things and people, oh my God, well, look, the coaches play a part in helping them improve, but they're all so relentlessly driven that you know, they're on their own journey and they're the ones that have got to where they are.
Love that, Mike. You know, it's funny. I was listening to you in the car yesterday, pretty late at night, actually, after tennis. And, you know, when I remember you saying a similar thing about, you know, being willing to just do, you know, what works tactically over and over again and having discipline to do that. And I was thinking, you know, it's just, it really simplifies things. Like I remember playing last night and just over and over, you know, trying to hit as many inside out forehands as possible to the opponent's backhand until I got a short ball and then, you know, going to the other side. And I did that over and over again. And then I thought and reflected about how important it is to just be willing to do that instead of like other fancy things, you know, just doing the basics right, you know, over and over. So it's really definitely hit home. So
I think just touching on that is again, I use the analogy, like in order to build a house that doesn't fall over, the foundations have to be set first, i.e. the basics. If the basics are done really, really well, you know, i.e. you've got a high first serve percentage, i.e. you're not missing ball three, i.e. your return percentage is high, you're clear on the patterns you're looking to run in a match. If you can do all those things incredibly well, then the more creative aspects of your game are then can just be added as layers on top. And you can see that with the likes of Djokovic, Nadal and Federer. They have the basics both on court and off court nailed on. So then it allows them to be a little bit more creative in certain moments. So yeah, no need to ever overcomplicate things. Just get the basics done really, really well.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's such a great point. Because yeah, when I was playing, like I saw a lot of other players they seemed like they didn't have any set patterns. They were just like trying different shots all the time. And you know, so I think, yeah, like you mentioned, just sticking to your strengths and, you know, weaknesses wise, just, you know, like I was thinking with my own game, like as long as I can have like a, you know, consistent backhand that allows me to stay in the rally until I can, you know, maybe change the pattern up to get it to my forehand again, that's really all I need. So, you know, your tip to focus on your strengths more than your weaknesses is also obviously very important there. You know, aside from the things that you've learned, I also know that it's super fun for the audience to hear about like your experiences as far as like, you know, who was fun, who wasn't. And obviously, as you know, I mentioned, I heard about, you know, maybe a certain Italian player that was a tough experience for you. But let's go the other way first and then say, I think you mentioned that Novak Djokovic was a great experience, but like, were there any other players specifically that you don't mind naming, at least that you really felt like you connected with and that they were really friendly and nice?
Yeah, so two spring to mind, mainly because I was probably on court the most with them. One would be Roger Federer.
Nice.
And the other one would be Simona Halep. And that's purely because I spent a good amount of time with them in certain periods. I was with Federer for a good amount of time in London when the ATP Finals was at the O2 in London. And then I've been with Halep kind of on and off at different events. I've practiced with her at different events over a series of months, or just under a year or so. So like I said earlier, I think when you are with someone more often, you just naturally build up a little bit more of a connection. And yeah, so it's, yeah, those two would, for me, would be the two that I would say that I've been around the most.
Got it. And then was there anyone else that maybe, like, even though you hadn't practiced with them a lot, just like first interaction, like, oh wow, this person's really funny, or they're really friendly and nice, or something like that?
Oh yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of them are really nice. I mean, I've also practiced with Medvedev a lot. He's great person to be around. I was practiced with him at Wimbledon, again at the ATP Finals, US Open. So yeah, I've been around him a lot. So again, when you keep coming back, you recognize each other, you have conversations that aren't tennis related, and you can kind of, you know, just view them more as someone you can have a chat to. I think the one that's just sprung to mind, actually, that I was with for about a week at Wimbledon was, because I think maybe it was his first Wimbledon, or definitely one of his first Wimbledons, he made the fourth round and actually ended up playing four lefties in a row, was Ali Yassin, Felix Auger-Aliassime.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And I think being a very similar age to Felix at the time, we spent the best part of a week, or the Monday to Saturday, with each other, warming up, practicing every day, because he ended up playing obviously four lefties. And he's a great, great guy, like really, really nice, very welcoming, very warm, clearly, a very, very, very good tennis player, and he's got a very bright future. And, but yeah, he always said hello. We always used to have some nice conversations on the court, off the court. And yeah, that week that we spent together at Wimbledon, I was hitting with him, was, yeah, that actually sticks out now I think about it. Yeah, really, really genuine person that, clearly loves the sport.
Yeah, I can, you know, obviously I've never really been or close to him or around him, but he seems like a really nice guy as well. Just watching him live and on TV. But can you tell us, like, any sort of, specifics on, like, interactions, like if there was any funny banter or a funny joke, or, you know, like somebody played a prank on you or anything like that, like anything that you think that you found pretty funny and memorable with a player?
There's obviously certain things that I probably can't repeat.
But, we'll blank it out. But, no kidding.
Yeah, no. But I do remember, I'm sure it was 2018 when I was at Wimbledon, and it was the World Cup, and England were playing Sweden in the World Cup. Can't remember what stage it was. Maybe, was it the quarterfinal? I can't, it's so bad. I'm English and I can't remember. Oh, so bad. But I remember watching that with Kyrgios in the players' lounge. And
oh, wow. And
it was just hilarious because he obviously had no idea what was going on, and almost trying to tell a few. I was watching it with a few of, like, the English, there's a few other hitting partners, but then also a couple coaches. He was as good of a guy Kyrgios is. I think he's a really nice guy. I think sometimes he's misunderstood. Yeah, he was trying to tell us about how to play football, and it didn't go down well. And Aussie telling the English how to play football. So, that one does stick out because, yeah, he's a real, real character and good fun to be around.
Nice. Very nice. Wow. Yeah, I actually looked it up. So it was England, Sweden, quarterfinals.
Quarterfinals. Wow, that's it.
Yeah. Wow, I can't believe Maguire scored. And then our former Hotspur player, Dele Alli, scored. Oh, interesting.
Ah, there you go. There you go. I was probably so focused on what Kyrgios was saying that I completely forgot that what the scores. But I do remember we won that match. That's what I do remember.
Yeah, that's a good one for the English. Very cool. And then okay, so let's go the other way in terms of, like, like maybe your toughest experience, or a couple of them, you know, ones that didn't go well that you're comfortable, you know, mentioning here.
Yeah. Well, look, I've been very fortunate that I've had 95% of the time there's been some amazing experiences. I've played it on some amazing courts in some amazing cities. But the one for me that definitely was tough to take, not from a playing standpoint, more from the fact where it was with Fognini. And again, nothing against Fabio Fognini. I think he's an unbelievable tennis player. I think he puts smiles on so many people's faces when he's on the court. And I purposely go out of my way to watch him play. I think he's amazing. But whatever it was on that day, whether it was me just genuinely not being a good enough hitting partner or whether he wasn't in the best of moods, yeah, he wasn't happy with me. And yeah, very quickly got rid of me on the practice court. And there's like four courts at Arangi Park at Wimbledon where that they're raised at the top, where a lot of like the seeded players would practice, both men and women. And we were on, I think we were on the third court, and there was like Djokovic was practicing maybe, and then Federer, then Raonic. And then I was like in between with Fognini and me. And for whatever on that day, and it was strange because I'd been doing a lot of hits and I'd been with Novak and all these players, and I was fine going on. And then I stepped on the court and was pretty nervous, like which was normal, but then also it wasn't normal because I'd had a good amount of experience at that time. And yeah, it just didn't start well. And yeah, one to, it's funny. I find it funny. I'm pretty open and honest with talking about it now, but definitely one that I look back and think, oh, yeah, I've definitely had some better experiences.
Dang. And I guess generally, what is it that makes you nervous? So I know you mentioned like the connection. If you know the player and you have a connection, then you're not so nervous. But I mean, besides that, like, what are things that do make you nervous, or is it just like totally random?
Yeah, it depends, isn't it? I think every player brings things that you're wary of. So like if you're practicing with someone like a Halep, I know that I need to make lots of balls. I know I need to flatten the ball out because, you know, generally the women play a little bit flatter, lower trajectory over the net. But with Fognini, I know that he can be a little bit of a character, which is, if he's in a great mood, it's great. But if he's not, it's a little bit more challenging. So maybe I went into it a little bit more apprehensive than I normally would do. And you know, it brought out a few emotions that I was nervous and everything. But I think, yeah, you're just wary. I think you're wary because it's like, for me, yes, they are, a lot of them are global icons. But I think sometimes what we forget is I'm helping them do their job. So if I'm not doing my job, then it doesn't help them do their job. So then naturally, like anyone in any industry, if you've got someone in that you've brought in that you want to help you and they're not, you're obviously not going to be in the best moods, or you're going to have words and you're going to speak to them. And I think, you know, because it's a very emotional sport and it's very competitive and adrenaline runs high, you know, naturally people are going to get, you know, annoyed with each other and not quite like the way you do certain things. So it's pretty normal in the world of sport, I'd say.
Yeah, Mike, and I loved hearing your philosophy and approach to being a practice partner, which is to just, you know, help the player succeed. Like I think you mentioned there was some, maybe a player who was, you know, a practice partner who was just trying to like beat the pro, and then the pro was kind of getting like annoyed. It might have been Nadal, actually, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, but, I kind of remember that.
yeah. So can you maybe name one more experience? Because I remember you mentioned that with Fognini, like you were like shanking, you know, the first few balls and it didn't, you know,
minutes
or something like that. So maybe one other one with like, maybe like a, whatever highest ranked pro that you can remember where the practice just didn't go well, and walk us through like why that was.
So I'm racking my brain here because I'm sure I've had some, but I'm trying to remember over the years, but I've had ones. I remember one with Tsitsipas at the ATP finals. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's not that it went poorly, but I wasn't playing well. That was just I didn't start well again, wasn't playing well. And I could feel that. Mouratoglou, who was on the court, could feel that. And so Stefanos could definitely feel it. And I think that he got a little bit frustrated, but then I kind of had a bit of a word with myself and I said, right, okay, Michael, like, you got to step up now. You know, you need to step up now. And I think I just snapped myself out of it, and then my level increased, and I managed to turn it around. But I've been lucky, you know, as much as I've had, you know, worked very hard for the experiences that I've created for myself. I have been lucky in a sense that I think one of my strengths is being able to build connections and relationships. And yeah. I think that all of a sudden, if you can do that over the time and as a hitting partner, it eases the pressure off me. And then I think hopefully it allows the player to feel like that, look, I'm here to help you. I'm not here to beat you, because in reality, yeah. I'm not going to. So it's that whole idea of, look, I'm here to try and help you out. And then that's how I, you know, had a few players ask me back wanting to practice. And I truly believe it's not because I'm an unbelievable tennis player. I just think it's like anything. They felt comfortable with me on the court, and that then allowed them to feel like that they could practice freely.
Nice, nice. And obviously, I mean, part of that is like just trying to figure out how you can help them. But is there any other ways that you like make them feel as comfortable as possible?
I think, again, with the players, like your Halleps and not so much Federer, but mainly Halep, was being a lefty. We have certain patterns, again, that we like to do. A lot of general patterns that lefties, you know, play. Like, they prefer doing certain things on the tennis court. Obviously, the serves coming in a little bit different. So I would never say, but I would always also offer my advice as to, you know, if someone's playing, Halep's playing Kvitova, you know, or what would she do? Or what, as a lefty, what do you think normally happens? Now, look, a lot of these players have played all these players before, and they don't need so much advice from the hitting partner unless I was actually their coach. But it's sometimes nice to have a little bit of a view from someone that's coming from outside of the team, a little bit to kind of, you know, zoom out and go, right, okay, this is what I think, and this is how, you know, I play as a lefty. You'd often try and help out with that. But again, for me, the biggest thing, keep it fun, keep it lighthearted. You know, try and make them smile, like, and they enjoy that. They genuinely, as serious as some of them look on the practice courts, they also just want to keep it nice and relaxed. And I think that's really important, especially when you're in and around and playing these big events.
All right. I really hope that you enjoyed my interview with Mike Digby. And Mike, thanks for coming on to the show. I really enjoyed chatting with you. And of course, as I mentioned, part two will be coming out next week. So just click on to the next episode if you're listening to this over 1 week from when this show right here came out. That made sense. I hope it did. But in any case, thank you very much for listening. And you can find all the links that we mentioned today on the show on the show notes page. And if you enjoyed this episode and if you enjoy the podcast, then would definitely appreciate it if you would leave a review for the podcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite app that you use to listen to the show, Apple Podcasts. Their URL is tennisfiles.com/Apple Podcasts. Well, at least the URL for my show, not their URL, but it will redirect to their site. I also do want to leave you with a quote, as I often do at the end of the show. And this one is by Wayne Gretzky, a hockey legend. And Wayne said, "You miss 100% of the shots you don't take." Really love that one. And lastly, definitely want to have you join in on Tennis Summit 2022, which includes over 40 of the top tennis coaches on the planet who give you on-court lessons, masterclass presentations, and live Q&As, over 40 of them, with coaches such as Paul Anacone, Rick Macy, Peter Freeman, Will Hamilton, Gigi Fernandez, Dr. Mark Kovacs, Ryan Reedy, and many, many other amazing coaches. And you can get your free ticket to watch all of these sessions for free at tennisfilesummit.com. And again, check the show notes for that link if you just want to head there and click without having to type anything in your internet browser or whatever you call those of choice. Obviously, I know what they're called, but you know. Just joking around. I am definitely overworked right now, I think. But, you know, it's all in good fun, just working on the summit, prepping for it. So I hope to see you there. And I'll also see you on next week's episode. So you have a great one. Stay safe, play a lot of tennis, and keep improving your tennis game. This is Mehrban Aranchad signing out.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.